Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Eric Kruglansky, a distinguished university professor of psychology at the University of Maryland College Park, and has been at the forefront of research into closed-mindedness or the need for closure, in particular its relationship to fundamentalist belief systems and violent extremism. He is a fellow of the American Psychological Association and has edited a variety of prominent journals, including the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Attitudes and Social Cognition. During his long career, he has received numerous awards, including the Donald Campbell Award for Outstanding Contributions to Social Psychology. His work in the domains of human judgment and belief formation has been disseminated in over 300 articles, and he's the author of 6 books, including The Psychology of Closed-Mindedness and The Psychology of Terrorism. And the themes explored in these books will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Eric. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Good to be here.
Okay, well, perhaps you could begin by telling us something of your background and what first sparked your interest in this field of work.
I was always interested in philosophy of science.
Okay.
Avidly reading Popper and Kuhn,
yeah,
and Lakatos and Feyerabend.
Yeah.
And I was interested in Popper's idea that the process of hypothesis generation and testing is in principle interminable,
yeah,
that it can go on, and there is no unique objective point of stopping it. And so the question arises, how do we arrive at knowledge? How do we stop that process of incessant hypothesis testing and information gathering and generating hypotheses and testing them and looking for more and more information and evidence? And I discovered that the process is psychological. What they call a stopping mechanism is a psychological mechanism that nature equipped us with, and we call it in psychology the need for cognitive closure. So at some point, that need intensifies and convinces you that enough evidence is enough, and you're justified in making a judgment without gathering further information. So my concept of the need for cognitive closure relates to Popper's and others' idea of a stopping mechanism that truncates that interminable process of generating hypotheses and gathering information.
Oh, very interesting. Okay, well, could you just say what you mean by social cognition and how that marks us out from other species?
We are distinct from other species in 2 ways. We are social, but other species as well are social. Ants, bees, all kinds of mammals are very social. But we are also very cognitive, more cognitive. Our cortex is more developed than of other species. We are Homo sapiens. We are the thinking species. But the conjunction of the social and the cognitive creates social cognition. We are dependent for information on other people. Other people from our parents onward, our peers, experts of all kinds, our community, our in-group, are sources of information that we believe in. So we get our worldview, our picture of reality from other people. That's why social cognition is what makes us human.
Okay, and how does that relate to this idea of closed-mindedness, or the term I believe you coined, the need for closure?
The need for closure is the motivation, and as I said, it's a motivation that is needed for us to reach a decision or reach a judgment. You cannot reach a judgment. You cannot cross a road. You cannot decide what to wear. You cannot get up in the morning without a judgment that this is the right thing to do. So at some point, but you could keep on asking the question of whether, in fact, your decision is justified and gather additional information incessantly. So that would put you in a kind of loop and promote a paralysis by overanalysis. Would not be very functional because we'll never get out of bed, we'll never cross the road, we'll never put our shoes on. Obviously, this would not be very practical. So we have this need for closure that tells us enough information is enough. So need for closure is a necessary stopping mechanism in order to reach a judgment. Now, people vary on the intensity of that need for closure. Some people reach judgments very quickly, prematurely, impulsively. Other people agonize over their judgments for extended periods of time. And I think your notion of the middle way is that we need some optimal degree of closure, not too premature and not too extensive information processing in order to reach functional judgment. And most of humanity does that in most circumstances because we function or we do things. However, in many cases, this gets out of whack and we either reach premature closure and make a very bad mistake that was avoidable, or keep agonizing and are missing opportunities to act.
Okay, so so obviously at one extreme, then you're endlessly deliberating,
yeah.
But we obviously need to act. But this trait can be exaggerated in people or made more prevalent by certain conditions. And it's this that gets us into trouble.
Very often it gets us into trouble. When we are low on resources, when there is time pressure, and it's very difficult to process information, either because we are tired or because there is noise in the environment or because we are busy with other things that impinge on our agenda. Under those conditions, we develop a need for closure. We make snap judgments, and often these judgments can get us into trouble.
And what sort of trouble?
Well, for example, we may reach premature judgments. We may meet a person, and based on a very small sample of information, for example, their gender or their race or their ethnicity or their age, form a judgment that is unwarranted. Should we have looked at further information, we would not have reached that kind of judgment. In other words, it renders our vulnerable to stereotypes and prejudices that can be very pernicious and antisocial in their consequences.
Okay, and could it also be related to the decisions made, for example, during the economic crash?
Yes, during the economic crash, we might be very stressed out. We might be consumed by our economic situation. And under those conditions, our cognitive resources are invested elsewhere, and we do not have enough wherewithal, cognitively speaking, to reach a deliberate, well-considered judgment. So all kinds of stresses, economic stresses, physical stresses, environmental stresses, fatigue, and so forth, can intensify your need for closure. You need to truncate your deliberations, occasionally prematurely. By the way, let me just add one thing.
Yeah.
It also predisposes you to simplistic viewpoints, to black and white ideologies, to Manichaean narratives of black and white, of good versus evil, us versus them, for us versus against us, because these provide very quick certainty and closure. And very often these simplistic narratives, these simplistic viewpoints are simply out of step with reality. And they are detrimental to managing your behavior, your conduct, your relations with others in the optimal way.
The term we use for that way of thinking in our society is absolutization. To us, it's very much related to cognitive bias theory. What connection do you see between the need for closure and these cognitive biases that are, you know, very much part of our evolutionary makeup?
Well, in many cases, those biases are based on the use of heuristics rather than careful information processing. And in case if those heuristics are wrong, they are not always wrong, but in case they are wrong, because they are simple and readily accessible, they tend to be latched upon, seized upon by people under high need for cognitive closure. And that can bias their information processing. But let me point out, these heuristics can be occasionally quite functional.
Yeah, they've helped us for thousands, if not millions of years.
Exactly. And the work of my friend Georgi Gerenze illustrates that extremely well.
Okay. I know from my own experience that being wrong or acknowledging that I'm wrong is often an unpleasant feeling. But also being wrong, you know, before that recognition, feels right. So how do we know where we're being closed-minded? How can we be receptive to the fact that we sometimes think in this narrow way?
I think one solution is the kind of philosophy that is espoused by Buddhism. Don't be too attached to your ideas and assume that you might be wrong. As a basic principle, as a basic assumption that guides your activities, assume that you could be wrong. And if you make that assumption, then you will be open and flexible to alternative information. You will be willing to change your mind because you're not so invested in being right. You assume as a general premise that you could be wrong. And so I think that attitude is worth cultivating.
Yeah.
The second thing is know thyself. The principle of knowing thyself. Know that you are predisposed to high need for closure. Know that you tend to, under certain circumstances or generally, prefer certainty to uncertainty. So when you feel too certain and you know that you are prone to need for closure, this may mitigate your confidence. This may attenuate your tendency to take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, I'm just experiencing that in my own life at the moment, Eric. I'm doing a carpentry project with a neighbor, and I often feel that I'm a person that, you know, is quite laid back, etc. However, I've noticed when in situations when things don't work out quite right, we cut a piece of wood wrong. My natural reaction, I've noticed, is to go shit, whereas he goes okay. Uh-huh. And so I'm sort of learning a lot from this guy, that he sees a problem as something that's interesting rather than that's something that's irritating. And I'm finding that process very helpful.
Very interesting.
Okay. Now, this need for closure not only works at the individual level, but within groups too. Am I right in saying that?
Well, I think the relation between need for closure and tendency to rely on groups and to be a groupie kind of person is very interesting. Because if you have a high need for closure, you want certainty. And groups, your in-groups, your networks, your friends, your colleagues, your relatives, people who you respect, are the major source of closure. They validate your opinions. And therefore, because your certainty is so important to you, you tend to value the source of certainty, and therefore you tend to value your group to a greater extent than people who have low need for closure. So the tendency to have a high need for closure leads you to be what we call group-centric. You are a group member that appreciates the group and can be very disparaging to groups that are in conflict with your group. So it's again related to the us versus them kind of thinking. So you are favorable toward in-group and unfavorable toward out-group. Another aspect of the need for closure that relates to groupiness is that you prefer groups that provide firm closure. And such groups are often ones that whose governance is autocratic, because in an autocratic group, everybody is entitled to the boss's opinion. So it's the boss who determines what the social reality of the group is, whereas in a democratic society, there is a diversity of opinion, which creates uncertainty, which creates ambiguity. And that is not a preferable type of group for a person who is high on the need for closure. And as a consequence, we find in our research, 50 years of research on political conservatism, is that political conservatives tend to be higher on the need for cognitive closure than liberals. Conservatives are more concerned about tradition, about certainty, about decisiveness. Liberals are more open and flexible. Some may say wishy-washy. Yeah. Some may say less committed to the group, less appreciative of the group than are conservative.
But then, for example, communism, there's an absolute belief there that, you know, that the at the end of history, there'll be the communist utopia. And so then, you know, any end can justify the means.
Yes. So any kind of belief, including religion, you know, people who are high on the need for closure are known to be more religious than people who are low on the need for closure. So any tendency to adhere to a very regimented, structured, clear-cut, black and white, good versus bad type of belief, such as religion, such as communism, such as fascism, such as a variety of different narratives, would be appealing to people who are high on the need for closure.
In the last few years, you've been doing a lot of work in relation to terrorism, and obviously there's a very strong connection between this need for closure and terrorism. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, there are actually two motivational bases that predispose people to extremism and radicalization. One of them is the need for closure. This is the idea that during times of uncertainty, it could be economic recession, it could be political turmoil, it could be the kind of uncertainty that is spawned by immigration, the refugee crisis, otherness that sweeps a nation, all kinds of different people that are different from you, question and invalidate your view of the world. All of that creates uncertainty that promotes a need for closure, and that promotes the adherence to an ideology that provides closure, such as, you know, the West is against Islam, or Islam is against the West. And, you know, there's us versus them, and we've got to fight them. You know, of course, violence is the ultimate closure-providing vehicle, because you want to simply annihilate the other person, and that person will no longer pose any kind of danger. So it's very clear-cut. Death is the ultimate closure. So that's one big source of radicalization, this need for closure that comes from uncertainty. Also, during adolescence, transition, life transition from childhood to adulthood, there is great uncertainty concerning your future, concerning what will you be, how will you fare, yeah. Will you succeed? And under those conditions, there is a tendency to, again, develop a high need for closure, high need for certainty. We know a lot about adolescent certainty. They tend to be cocksure in their views, even though they do not know very much.
Yeah.
So that kind of circumstance, that's why many extremists typically are rather young. Yeah. Terrorists are young people. So that's one source. Need for closure is one source. The other source, which is different, is the need for significance, the need to matter, the need to have respect, to amount to something. And I think the ideologies that are provided, say the extremist ideology of Islamic State or other such ideologies, provide both closure and significance. They tell you exactly what to do in order to be a hero, a martyr, to be adulated, to be worshipped, to become a very important person.
Okay, so given that understanding, have you any ideas how we can tackle this problem?
Well, in our theory of radicalization, there are three components. There is the motivational component that we just discussed.
Yeah.
You know, the need for closure and need for significance combined. There is the narrative component that tells you how to attain closure and significance. And the third N, it's need, narrative, and the third N is the network, the 3N model of radicalization. The network consists of the group that validates your opinions, validates the narrative. So in order to counter that, we need to address the need through an alternative that provides alternative ways of getting closure and getting significance. And we need to immerse the individual in a network structure that validates this alternative counter-extremist view. In other words, you have to reverse the process that radicalization was based on by reversing, by addressing the need. The need is, you're not going to eliminate the need. It's universal and essential, but you can rechannel it through a narrative and through a supportive network.
And to what degree would you say that approach resonates with the actual policy of, say, the US or in Europe towards terrorism now?
I think there are attempts in Muslim states from Saudi Arabia, Singapore that has a Muslim minority, Indonesia. There was an attempt in Egypt and in Yemen. There were attempts to deal with it, particularly in terms of deradicalizing imprisoned terrorists. In the UK, you have the PREVENT program that attempts a counter-radicalization. In Denmark, you have the Aarhus model that is based on psychological work that attempts to address radicalization from a very young age all the way to dealing with returning fighters through all kinds of community structures, social services, the police, religious organization, and so forth. In Germany, you have a variety of counter-violent extremism programs. So there are attempts to deal with it in various ways. I think dealing with it has to be based on a deep understanding of the psychology of it, and that's what we're trying to propagate.
So what would you say the opposite of closed-mindedness?
I would say that the opposite of the need for closure is the need to avoid closure. Some people feel very uncomfortable with closure because of a variety of reasons, one of which is that they cannot tolerate the thought of making a mistake.
Yeah.
So would rather not reach a judgment than have a judgment that could be proven to be wrong. Some people avoid commitment because reaching closure implies a commitment, a cognitive commitment. And some people feel very uncomfortable because it reduces their options, their space of possible ways of thinking or acting. The need to avoid closure is the need to be open-minded. But, of course, if you take it ad absurdum, this creates what we discussed earlier, an inability to reach a judgment, to reach an opinion, to commit to a given state, to commit to a person, to commit to a profession, to commit to a country. And so that's also dysfunctional. The middle way, as you are suggesting, is the best way, the optimal way of closure. And of course, we cannot pinpoint exactly what it is. It's probably different for different people. But your awareness of where you stand on the need for closure continuum, your self-reflection and self-awareness could be helpful in determining for you when do you have to be careful lest you make a premature closure or are paralyzed by your tendency to avoid closure.
Okay. Then wisdom arguably is somewhere between those two extremes.
Yeah.
So you've talked earlier about what's critical for making more adequate judgments is an openness to being wrong, holding your views lightly, what we call in the society provisionality.
Yes.
And the curiosity as well. Now,
yeah.
Now obviously these are dispositional factors to an extent, but do you think these things can be cultivated as well, and if so, how?
I think so. I think, in the human psyche, there is always the interplay of nature versus nurture. Your dispositional qualities can be tempered, can be modified, can be altered by situational influences. So I think it's important that your self-awareness could be one such influence, and your awareness of your dispositional tendencies that could be physiological, could be genetic, but your awareness of their impact and their consequences could lead you to expose yourself to situations that mitigate those if they are excessive and dysfunctional.
Okay, and what are your thoughts on integrative practices such as mindfulness or engagements in the arts or participating in critical thinking or philosophy? Do you think those sort of things can help?
I love the arts and I love philosophy, and I think critical thinking, I'm a firm believer that motivation drives the cognitive process.
Yeah.
Motivation is the dog that wags the tail of cognition. Motivation is the king. Yeah. And the cognition is the handmaiden of motivation. So just teaching somebody critical skills does not mean that this person is going to be critical when it comes to things that he or she desires. They may be critical of other things that they do not desire, or critical of counter-argue narratives that are inconsistent with what they desire. But it's the motivation. So critical thinking per se would not do much without very close attention to the motivational basis of cognition.
Yeah, I absolutely agree there, Eric. I came across some interesting research recently by a guy called Dan Kahan, who was saying that that intelligence and education are no real safeguard against blinkered thinking, because often you can articulate your way better out of cognitive dissonance. You've got the tools, basically, and the vocabulary to argue and convince your way out of it. But and again, he says what's key is curiosity and this openness to being wrong,
which are motivational factors.
Exactly. And for me, what I find really helpful in my own life is on that regard, working at the level of motivation or desire is mindfulness practices, because you sit with your experience and you learn to respond to it rather than react. Rather than rushing to judgment, you can actually feel what's going on in your body and learn to actually see what happens when you get emotionally hijacked.
Right, exactly. And the Buddhist idea of detachment is, again, mitigating the hold that motivation has over your psyche.
Yeah. Very much so. No, I'm fully in agreement there, Ari. Have there been studies to assess how a need for closure might affect our well-being in general?
Need for closure, when it's satisfied, when you have a high need for closure and you have closure, you are happy. When you have a low need for closure and you have no closure, you are happy. So happiness or well-being depends on your satisfaction of your motivational states. So it's not that closure in general promotes well-being or the absence of well-being. It all depends on your motivational state and the extent to which the existing cognitive situation satisfied that motivation.
Okay, but then if you're making decisions in that sort of messy middle and you're arguably making better ones because you've got a wider range of alternatives and you're open to being wrong and you're curious about other things, then the chances are those decisions will help you leave a more effective life. For example, say tomorrow night I went out and I had a choice of having 6 glasses of wine or 1 glass of wine. Uh-huh. My experience in life tells me it's better to drink 1 glass of wine, because I've got more compassion now for my future self than I had when I was in my 20s.
Yes.
But that's come through experience, and that experience has come to an extent making those decisions in that messy middle.
Right.
And that actually helps with my well-being.
Right. So knowing, what will be the consequences of your actions, experience, learning, all of that can help you attain your goal and your goals and fulfill your desires, such as they are.
Yeah.
But I think in general, well-being comes from satisfying your wishes and your desires, your needs. And that depends. Different people have different needs. Some people desire closure, and these people would be very, very unhappy in the absence of closure, at least momentarily.
Yeah.
In the long run, it may serve them well, should they be able to postpone, to delay their closure, they might ultimately reach better outcomes than people who decided impulsively on the basis of their need. But at the moment, if a desire is for closure is burning, having closure is what gives you peace of mind.
I imagine then, from what you're saying, there must be a strong link between a need for closure and addiction too.
Yes, yes, absolutely, yes. It's impulsive, succumbing to temptations of various sorts, because these things are accessible. And if you have a high need for closure, you decide quickly and you decide positively.
Yeah.
All kinds of addictions to shopping, to drinking, to eating are associated with the need for closure.
Okay, my last question. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
They can visit my website and they could read my book on closed-mindedness. I'm finishing a book on radicalization, but I think a website is a good place to start.
Okay, well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you today, Ari, and absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure the listeners will have really found it very interesting too. So thank you very much for giving up your time to talk to me today.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it very much, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.